Side 9. They dragged me from the room along a passage, and I roared for help and called Gulshar every filthy name I could lay tongue to. He strode on ahead, heedless, and presently threw open a door. They ran me across the threshold, and I found I was in a low-vaulted chamber, perhaps 20 yards long. I had half expected racks and thumbscrews or some such horrors, but the room was entirely bare. The one curious feature of it was that halfway it was cut in two by a deep culvert, perhaps 10 feet wide and 6 deep. It was dry, and where it ran into the walls on either side, the openings were stopped up with rubble. This had obviously been done only recently, but I could not imagine why. Gulshar turned to me. "Are you strong, Flashman?" "Damn you," I shouted. "You'll pay for this, you dirty nigger." "Are you strong?" he repeated. "Answer, or I'll have your tongue cut out."
One of the ruffians grabbed my jaw in his hairy paw and brought his knife up to my mouth. It was a convincing argument.
"Strong enough, damn you." "I doubt that," smiled Gulshar. "We have executed 2 rascals here of late, neither of them weaklings. But we shall see." To one of his crew he said, "Bring Mansur." "I should explain this new entertainment of mine," he went on, gloating at me. "It was inspired partly by the unusual shape of this chamber, with its great trench in the middle, and partly by a foolish game which your British soldiers play. Doubtless you have played it yourself, which will add interest for you, and us. Yeah, Mansur, come here."
As he spoke, a grotesque figure waddled into the room. For a moment I could not believe it was a man, for he was no more than 4 feet high, but he was terrific. He was literally as broad as he was long, with huge knotted arms and a chest like an ape's. His enormous torso was carried on massive legs. He had no neck, that I could see, and his yellow face was as flat as a plate, with a hideous nose spread across it, a slit of a mouth, and 2 black button eyes. His body was covered in dark hair, but his skull was as smooth as an egg. He wore only a dirty loincloth, and as he shuffled across to Gulshar, the torchlight in that windowless room gave him the appearance of some hideous Nibelung dragging itself through the dark burrows beneath the earth.
"A fine mannikin, is he not?" said Gulshar, regarding the hideous imp. "Your soul must be as handsome, Flashman, which is fitting, for he is your executioner."
He snapped an order, and the dwarf, with a glance at me and a contortion of his revolting mouth, which I took to be a grin, suddenly bounded into the culvert, and with a tremendous spring leapt up the other side, catching the edge and flipping up like an acrobat. That done, he turned and faced us, arms outstretched, a disgusting yellow giant in miniature. The men who held me now dragged my arms in front of me and bound my wrists tightly with a stout rope. One of them then took the coil and carried it across to the dwarf's side of the culvert. The mannikin made a hideous bubbling noise and held his wrists up eagerly, and they were bound as mine had been. So we stood, on opposite edges of the culvert, bound to ends of the same rope, with the slack of it lying in the great trench between us. There had been no further word of explanation, and in the hellish uncertainty of what was to come, my nerve broke. I tried to run, but they hauled me back, laughing, and the dwarf Mansur capered on his side of the culvert and snapped his fingers in delight at my terror.
"Let me go, you bastards," I roared, and Gulshar smiled and clapped his hands. "You start at shadows," he sneered. "Behold the substance." "Ya, Asaf."
One of his ruffians came to the edge of the trench, bearing a leather sack tied at the neck. Cautiously undoing it and holding it by the bottom, he suddenly upended it into the culvert. To my horror, half a dozen slim silver shapes that glittered evilly in the torchlight fell writhing into the gap. They plopped gently to the floor of the culvert and then slithered with frightening speed towards the sides. But they could not climb up at us, so they glided about their strange prison in deadly silence. You could sense the vicious anger in them as they slid about beneath us.
"Their bite is death," said Gulshar. "Is all now plain, Flashman? It is what you call a tug of war, you against Mansur. One of you must succeed in tugging the other into the trench, and then it takes a few moments for the venom to kill. Believe me, the snakes will be kinder than Nariman would have been." "Help!" I roared, although God knows I expected none. But the sight of those loathsome things, the thought of their slimy touch, of the stab of their fangs, I thought I should go mad.
I raged and pleaded, and that Afghan swine clapped his hands and yelled with laughter. The dwarf Mansur hopped in eagerness to begin, and presently Gulshar stepped back, snapped an order to him, and said to me, "Pull for your life, Flashman, and present my salams to Shaitan." I had retreated as far as I could go from the culvert's edge, and was standing half-paralyzed when the dwarf snapped his wrists impatiently at the rope. The jerk brought me to my senses. As I've said before, terror is a wonderful stimulant. I braced my boot heels on the rough stone floor and prepared to resist with all my strength. Grinning, the dwarf scuttled backwards until the rope stretched taut between us. I guessed what his first move would be, and was ready for the sudden jerk when it came. It nearly lifted me off my feet, but I turned with the rope across my shoulder and gave him heave for heave. The rope drummed like a bowstring and then relaxed. He leered across at me and made a dribbling, piping noise. Then he bunched his enormous shoulder muscles and, leaning back, began to pull steadily. By God, he was strong. I strained until my shoulders cracked and my arms shuddered, but slowly, inch by inch, my heels slithered across the rough surface towards the edge of the trench. The Ghazis urged him on with cries of delight. Gulshar came to the brink so that he could watch me as I was drawn inexorably to the limit. I felt one of my heels slip into space. My head seemed to be bursting with the effort, and my ears roared, and then the tearing pain in my wrists relaxed, and I was sprawled on the very edge, exhausted, with the dwarf prancing and laughing on the other side, and the rope slack between us. The Ghazis were delighted, and urged him to give me a quick final jerk into the culvert, but he shook his head and backed away again, snapping the rope at me. I glanced down. The snakes seemed almost to know what was afoot, for they had concentrated in a writhing, hissing mass just below me. I scrambled back, wet with fear and rage, and hurled my weight on the rope to try to heave him off balance. But for all the impression I made, it might have been anchored to a tree. He was playing with me. There was no question that he was far the stronger of us two, and twice he hauled me to the lip and let me go again. Gulshar clapped his hands and the Ghazis cheered. Then he snapped some order to the dwarf, and I realized with sick horror that they were going to make an end. In despair, I rolled back again from the edge and got to my feet. My wrists were torn and bloody, and my shoulder joints were on fire, and when the dwarf pulled on the rope, I staggered forward, and in doing so, I nearly got him, for he had expected a stronger resistance, and he almost overbalanced. I hauled for dear life, but he recovered in time, glaring and piping angrily at me as he stamped his feet for a hold. When he had finally settled himself, he started to draw again on the rope, but not with his full strength, for he pulled me in only an inch at a time. This, I supposed, was the final hideous refinement. I struggled like a fish on a line, but there was no resisting that steady, dreadful pull. I was perhaps 10 feet from the lip when he turned away from me, as a tug-of-war team will when it has its opponents on the run, and I realized that if I was to make any last desperate bid, it must be now, while I had a little space to play with. I had almost unbalanced him by an accidental yielding. Could I do it deliberately? With the last of my strength, I dug my heels in and heaved tremendously. It checked him, and he glanced over his shoulder, surprise on the hideous face. Then he grinned and exerted his strength, lunging away on the rope. My feet slipped. "Go with God, Flashman," said Gulshar, ironically. I scrabbled for a foothold, found it only 6 feet from the edge, and then bounded forward. The leap took me to the very lip of the culvert, and the dwarf Mansur plunged forward on his face as the rope slackened. But he was up like a jack-in-the-box, gibbering with rage in an instant. Planting his feet, he gave a savage heave on the rope that almost dislocated my shoulders and flung me face down. Then he began to pull steadily so that I was dragged forward over the floor, closer and closer to the edge, while the Ghazis cheered and roared, and I screamed with horror. "No, no!" I shrieked. "Stop him! Wait! Anything! I'll do anything! Stop him!" My hands were over the edge now, and then my elbows. Suddenly there was nothing beneath my face, and through my streaming tears I saw the bottom of the culvert with the filthy worms gliding across it. My chest and shoulders were clear. In an instant I should overbalance. I tried to twist my head up in appeal to the dwarf and saw him standing on the far edge, grinning evilly and coiling the slack rope round his right hand and elbow like a washerwoman with a clothesline. He glanced at Gulshar, preparing to give the final pull that would launch me over, and then, above my own frantic babbling and the roaring in my ears, I heard the crash of a door flung open behind me, and a stir among the watchers, and a voice upraised in Pushtu. The dwarf was standing stock still, staring beyond me towards the door.
What he saw, I didn't know, and I didn't care. Half dead with fear and exhaustion as I was, I recognized that his attention was diverted, that the rope was momentarily slack between us, and that he was on the very lip of the trench. It was my last chance. I had only the purchase of my body and legs on the stone. My arms were stretched out ahead of me. I jerked them suddenly back, sobbing with all my strength. It was not much of a pull, but it took Mansour completely unawares. He was watching the doorway, his eyes round in his gargoyle face. Too late he realized that he had let his attention wander too soon. The jerk, slight as it was, unbalanced him, and one leg slipped over the edge. He shrieked and tried to throw himself clear, but his grotesque body landed on the very edge, and he hung for a moment like a seesaw. Then, with a horrible piping squeal, he crashed sprawling into the culvert. He was up again with a bound and springing for the rim, but by the grace of God he had landed almost on top of one of those hellish snakes, and even as he came upright it struck at his bare leg. He screamed and kicked at it, and the delay gave a second brute the chance to fix itself in his hand. He lashed out blindly, making a most ghastly din, and staggered about with at least two of the things hanging from him. He ran in his dreadful waddling way in a little circle, and fell forward on his face. Again and again the serpent struck at him. He tried feebly to rise, and then collapsed, his misshapen body twitching. I was dead beat with exertion and shock. I could only lie heaving like a bellows. Gulshar strode to the edge of the culvert and screamed curses at his dead creature. Then he turned, pointing to me, and shouted, "Fling that bastard in beside him!" They grabbed me and ran me to the pit's edge, for I could make no resistance. But I remembered I protested that it wasn't fair that I had won and deserved to be let go. They held me on the edge, hanging over the pit, and waited for the final word from my enemy. I closed my eyes to blot out the sight of the snarling faces and those dreadful reptiles, and then I was pulled back, and the hands fell away from me. Wondering, I turned wearily. They had all fallen silent, Gulshar with the rest of them. A man stood in the doorway. He was slightly under middle height, with the chest and shoulders of a wrestler, and a small, neat head that he turned from side to side, taking in the scene. He was simply dressed in a grey coat, clasped about with a belt of chain mail, and his head was bare. He was plainly an Afghan, with something of the pretty look that was so repulsive in Gulshar, but here the features were stronger and plumper. He carried an air of command, but very easily, without any of the strutting arrogance that so many of his race affected. He came forward, nodding to Gulshar, and eyeing me with polite interest. I noticed with astonishment that his eyes, oriental though they were in shape, were of vivid blue. That and the slightly curly dark hair gave him a European look which suited his bluff, sturdy figure. He sauntered to the edge of the culvert, clicked his tongue ruefully at the dead dwarf, and asked conversationally, "What has happened here?" He sounded like a vicar in a drawing-room. He was so mild, but Gulshar kept mum, so I burst out, "These swine have been trying to murder me!" He gave me a brilliant smile. "But without success," cried he. "I felicitate you. Plainly you have been in terrible danger, but have escaped by your skill and bravery. A notable feat, and what a tale for your children's children." It was really too much. Twice in hours I had been on the brink of violent death. I was battered, exhausted, and smeared with my own blood, and here I was conversing with a lunatic. I almost broke down in tears, and I certainly groaned. "Oh, Jesus!" The stout man raised an eyebrow. "The Christian prophet? Why, who are you, then?"
"I'm a British officer," I cried. "I've been captured and tortured by these ruffians, and they'd have killed me, too, with their hellish snakes. Whoever you are, you must—"
"In the 100 names of God," he broke in, "a Ferengi officer? Plainly there has been a very serious accident. Why did you not tell them who you were?"
I gaped at him, my head spinning. One of us must be mad.
"They knew," I croaked. "Gulshar knew."
"Impossible," says the stout fellow, shaking his head. "It could not be. My friend Gulshar would be incapable of such a thing. There has been an unfortunate error."
"Look," I said, reaching out towards him, "you must believe me. I am Lieutenant Flashman, on the staff of Lord Elphinstone, and this man has tried to do me to death. Not for the first time. Ask him," I shouted, "how I came here. Ask the lying, treacherous bastard."
"Never try to flatter Gulshar," said the stout man cheerfully. "He'll believe every word of it. No, there has been a mistake, regrettably, but it has not been irreparable, for which God be thanked, and my timely arrival, to be sure." And he smiled at me again. "But you must not blame Gulshar.
or his people. They did not know you for what you were. Now, as he said those words, he ceased to be a waggish madman. His voice was as gentle as ever, but there was no mistaking the steel underneath. Suddenly things became real again, and I understood that the kindly smiling man before me was strong in a way that folk like Gulshar could never be, strong and dangerous. And with a great surge of relief, I realized, too, that with him by, I was safe. Gulshar must have sensed it also, for he roused himself and growled that I was his prisoner, Ferengi officer or not, and he would deal with me. "No, he is my guest," said the stout man, reproving him. "He has met with a mishap on his way here, and needs refreshment and care for his wounds." "You have mistaken again, Gulshar. Now, we shall have his wrists unbound, and I shall take him to such entertainments as befits a guest of his importance." My bonds were cut off in a moment, and two of the Ghazis, the same evil-smelling brutes that a few moments ago had been preparing to hurl me to the snakes, supported me from that hellish place. I could feel Gulshar's eyes boring into my back, but he said not a word. It seemed to me that the only explanation was that this must be the stout man's house, and under the strict rules of Mussulman hospitality, his word was law. But in my exhausted state, I couldn't attempt to make sense of it all, and was only glad to stagger after my benefactor. They took me to a well-furnished apartment, and under the stout man's supervision, the crack in my head was bathed, the blood washed from my torn wrists, and oiled bandages applied. And then I was given strong mint tea and a dish of bread and fruit. Although my head ached damnably, I was famishing, not having eaten all day, and while I ate, the stout man talked. "You must not mind Gulshar," he said, sitting opposite me and toying with his small beard. "He is a savage. Wadigilzai isn't. And now that I think on your name, I connect you with the incident at Morgala some time ago. Bloody Lance, is it not?" And he gave me that tooth-flashing smile again. "I imagine you had given him cause for resentment." "There was a woman," I said. "I didn't know she was his woman." Which wasn't true, but that was by the way.
"There is so often a woman," he agreed. "But I imagine there was more to it than that. The death of a British officer at Morgala would have been convenient politically for Gul."
"Yes, yes, I see how it may have been. But that is past." He paused and looked at me reflectively.
"And so is the unfortunate incident in the cellar today. It is best, believe me, that it should be so. Not only for you personally, but for all your people here."
"What about Sikandar Burns and his brother?" said I. "Your soft words won't bring them back."
"A terrible tragedy," he agreed. "I admired Sikandar. Let us hope that the ruffians who slew him will be apprehended and meet with a deserved judgment."
"Ruffian," says I. "Good God, man, those were Akbar Khan's warriors, not a gang of robbers. I don't know who you are or what your influence may be, but you're behind the times where news is concerned. When they murdered Burns and sacked his residency, that was the beginning of a war. If the British haven't marched from their cantonment into Kabul yet, they soon will, and you can bet on that."
"I think you exaggerate," he said mildly. "This talk of Akbar Khan's warriors, for example."
"Look you," I said, "don't try to tell me. I rode in from the east last night. The tribes are up along the passes from here to Jagdullak and beyond, thousands of them. They're trying to wipe out Sale's force, and they'll be here as soon as Akbar has a mind to take Kabul and slit Shah Suja's throat and seize his throne. And God help the British garrison and loyalists like yourself who helped them as you've helped me." I tried to tell Burns this, and he laughed and wouldn't heed me. "Well, there you are." I stopped. All that talk had made me thirsty. When I'd taken some tea, I added, "Believe it or not, as you like."
He sat quiet for a moment, and then remarked that it was an alarming story, but that I must be mistaken.
"If it were as you say, the British would have moved by now, either out of Kabul or into the Bala Hisar fort, where they would be safe. They are not fools, after all."
"You don't know Elfie Bey, that's plain," says I, "or that ass McNaughton. They don't want to believe it, you see. They want to think all's well. They think Akbar Khan is still skulking away in the Hindu Kush. They refuse to believe that the tribes are rallying to him and ready to sweep the British out of Afghanistan."
He sighed.
"It may be, as you say, such delusions are common. Or they may be right, and the danger smaller than you think." He stood up. "But I am a thoughtless host. Your wound is paining you, and you need rest, Flashman Huzoor. I shall weary you no longer.
Here you can have peace, and in the morning we can talk again, among other things of how to return you safely to your people." He smiled, and the blue eyes twinkled. "We want no more mistakes from hotheads like Gulshar. Now, God be with you." I struggled up, but I was so weak and weary that he insisted I be seated again. I told him I was deeply grateful for all his kindness, that I would wish to reward him, but he laughed and turned to go. I mumbled some more thanks to him, and it occurred to me that I still didn't know who he was or how he had the power to save me from Gulshar. I asked him, and he paused in the curtained doorway. "As to that," he said, "I am the master of this house. My close friends call me Bakbuk, because I incline to talk. Others call me by various names as they choose." He bowed. "You may call me by my given name, which is Akbar Khan. Good night, Flashman Hazur, and a pleasant rest. There are servants within call if you need them." And with that he was gone, leaving me gaping at the doorway and feeling no end of a fool. In fact, Akbar Khan did not return next day, or for a week afterwards, so I had plenty of time to speculate. I was kept under close guard in the room, but comfortably enough. They fed me well and allowed me to exercise on a little closed veranda with a couple of armed Baruksis to keep an eye on me. But not a word would anyone say in answer to my questions and demands for release. I couldn't even discover what was going on in Kabul, or what our troops were doing, or what Akbar Khan himself might be up to. Or, most important of all, why he was keeping me prisoner. Then, on the eighth day, Akbar returned, looking very spruce and satisfied. When he dismissed the guards, he inquired after my wounds, which were almost better, asked if I was well cared for, and so forth, and then said that if there was anything I wished to know, he would do his best to inform me. Well, I lost no time in making my wishes known, and he listened, smiling and stroking his short black beard. At last he cut me off with a raised hand. "Stop, stop, Flashman Huzur. I see you are like a thirsty man. We must quench you a little at a time. Sit down now, and drink a little tea, and listen." I sat, and he paced slowly about the room, a burly, springy figure in his green tunic and pyjamas, which were tucked into short riding boots. He was something of a dandy, I noticed. There was gold lace on the tunic, and silver edging to the shirt beneath it. But again I was impressed by the obvious latent strength of the man. You could see it even in his stance, with his broad chest that always looked as though he was holding a deep breath, and his long, powerful hands. "First," he said, "I keep you here because I need you. How, you shall see later. Not today. Second, all is well in Kabul. The British keep to their cantonment, and the Afghans snipe at them from time to time and make loud noises. The king of Afghanistan, Shah Shuja," here he curled his lip in amusement, "since doing nothing among his women in the Bala Hisar, and calls to the British to help him against his unruly people. The mobs rule Kabul itself, each mob under its leader imagining that it alone has frightened the British off. They do a little looting and a little raping and a little killing, their own people, mark you, and are content for the moment. There you have the situation, which is most satisfactory. Oh, yes, and the hill tribes, hearing of the death of Secunder Burns, and of the rumoured presence in Kabul of one Akbar Khan, son of the true king, Dost Mohammed, are converging on the capital. They smell war and plunder. Now, Flashman Huzur, you are answered." Well, of course, in answering half a dozen questions, he had posed 100 others, but one above all I had to be satisfied about. "You say the British keep to their cantonment," I cried. "But what about Burns's murder? Do you mean they've done nothing?" "In effect, nothing," says he. "They are unwise, for their inaction is taken as cowardice. You and I know they are not cowards, but the Kabuli mobs don't, and I fear this may encourage them to greater excesses than they have committed already. But we shall see. However, all this leads me to my purpose in visiting you today, apart from my desire to inquire into your welfare." And he grinned again, that infectious smile which seemed to mock, but which I couldn't dislike. "You understand that if I satisfy your curiosity here and there, I also have questions which I would wish answered." "Ask away," says I, rather cautious. "You said at our first meeting that, or at least you implied, that Elphiston Sub and McLaughlin Sub were, how shall I put it, sometimes less than intelligent. Was that a considered judgment? Elphinstone Sub and McNaughton Sub, says I, are a pair of born bloody fools, as anyone in the bazaar will tell you. The people in the bazaar have not the advantage of serving on Elphiston Sub's staff, says he dryly. That is why I attach importance to your opinion. Now, are they trustworthy? This was a deuced odd question from an Afghan, I thought, and for a moment I nearly replied that they were English officers, blast his eyes. But you'd have been wasting your time talking that way to Akbar Khan. Yes, they're trustworthy, I said. One more than the other? Which would you trust with your horse or your wife? I take it you have no children. I didn't think long about this. I'd trust Elfie Bay to do his best like a gentleman, I said. But it probably wouldn't be much of a best. Thank you, Fleshman, says he. That is all I need to know. Now, I regret that I must cut short our most interesting little discussion, but I have many affairs to attend to. I shall come again, and we shall speak further. Now, hold on, I began, for I wanted to know how long he intended to keep me locked up, and a good deal more, but he turned me aside most politely and left. And there I was for another 2 weeks, damn him, with no one but the silent Baruchses for company. I didn't doubt what he had told me about the situation in Kabul was true, but I couldn't understand it. It made no sense. A prominent British official murdered, and nothing done to avenge him. As it proved, this was exactly what had happened. When the mob looted the residency and Secunda was hacked to bits, old Elfie and McNaughton had gone into the vapors, but they'd done virtually nothing. They had written notes to each other, wondering whether to march into the city, or move into the Bala Hissar fort, or bring Sale, who was still bogged down by the Gilzais at Gandamak, back to Kabul. In the end, they did nothing. And the Kabuli mobs roamed the city, as Akbar said, doing what they pleased, and virtually besieging our people in the cantonment. Elfie could, of course, have crushed the mobs by firm action, but he didn't. He just wrung his hands and took to his bed, and McNaughton wrote him stiff little suggestions about the provisioning of the cantonment for the winter. Meanwhile, the Kabulis, who at first had been scared stiff when they realized what they'd done in murdering Burns, got damned uppish and started attacking the outposts near the cantonment and shooting up our quarters at night. One attempt, and only one, was made to squash them, and that foul-tempered idiot Brigadier Shelton bungled it handsomely. He took a strong force out to Bay Maru, and the Kabulis, just a damn drove of shopkeepers and stable hands, mark you, not real Afghan warriors, chased him and his troops back to the cantonment. After that, there was nothing to be done. Morale in the cantonment went to rock bottom, and the countryside Afghans, who had been watching to see what would happen, decided they were onto a good thing and came rampaging into the city. The signs were that if the mobs and the tribesmen really settled down to business, they could swarm over the cantonment whenever they felt like it. End of side 9.